So we have with us James Corbett with the Corbett Report. The Corbett Report is edited, webmastered, written, produced, and hosted by James Corbett. James Corbett has been living and working in Japan since 2004. He started the Corbett Report website in 2007 as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. Since then, he has written, recorded, and edited thousands of hours of audio and video media for the website, including a podcast and several regular online video series. He produces video reports for GRTV and is the lead editorial writer for the International Forecaster, the weekly e-newsletter created by the late Bob Chapman. Well, it's really great to have you with us here, James. Are you reading me loud and clear there?
I am.
Sounds great. You know, I just want to jump right into this webinar. I got so many great questions to ask you here, things our listeners want to hear about. So I want to take advantage of this unique situation. This is an international forum we have going on here. You're a Canadian living in Japan, and essentially we're all being ruled by this, United States government with their globalist colleagues. So over here in America, our listeners are really motivated, reacting to everything that's been going around in the Obama administration, all of these things and further loss of freedom, loss of liberty. And the reaction to that has been understandably a sense of preparedness. People realize bad stuff is happening and more bad stuff can happen. So many people are reacting to that by getting prepared for whatever might occur in the future. And I'm really curious, being in another country and being someone from another country, living in another country, what's going on in Japan? Is there such a thing as a sense of preparedness like that? Or what about your fellow Canadians? I'm really curious about your perspective on all of that.
Well, I think here in Japan, it's an interesting situation because basically since the time that the big real estate bubble popped here in 1990-91, it has been a long, slow deflation of the economy. And try as they might for 2.5 decades, they haven't really been able to get any inflation going, any significant growth going. So what we've seen is a couple of decade-long process of people basically belt tightening since the heyday of the bubble years. And because of that, it seems that the population here has kind of gotten used to the idea of diminishing returns and diminishing expectations. Certainly in the post-war period, as the boom started and as Japan became a manufacturing and an export industrial base, there were people who were able to safely have that lifestyle, which is the typical Japanese office worker lifestyle, where you join a company when you're fresh out of university and you work with that company until you're ready to retire, and then you get the golden watch and the nice retirement package. And that is pretty much the way entire generations here have been raised to understand and expect their place in the workforce. That is obviously changing, and Japan, very much like the United States, now has a lot of temporary part-time contract workers, and not exactly the same sense that you're going to be working your entire life in the same company. And so there are societal changes and economic changes and all sorts of political changes that take place on top of that structure. And I think we've reached the point where we're now under Prime Minister Abe here, who was elected really specifically about his promises to really get the Japanese economy going again. And he had this Abenomics that was going to change everything and make everything great again, make Japan great again, I guess. But that, of course, signally has failed to happen. And again, they can't even get any inflation going, even if, as much as they try to pump money into the economy. So it's really a pretty depressing situation in a lot of ways, and I think that's reflected in a lot of different things, including the demographics here, where, of course, famously, it is now officially a dying country. There are more people dying than being born every year. The population is shrinking. There are now more adult diapers being sold than baby diapers.
Yeah, I heard that.
And people are getting married later and later, if at all, and it's a pretty bleak situation in a lot of ways. So I don't know if there's any particular added sense of urgency right now. It's really just the sense that this is kind of the way things are heading, and the way the demographics are baked into the cake, perhaps that is true at this point. Unless there's some sort of truly game-changing event that takes place, I don't know if there's anything that would pull Japan out of that.
So it's more of a from the perspective of the Japanese, or the perspective that you see, more of a slow change. People have less chance of reliable income and occupation in the future, but nothing has happened that's enormously rapidly, you know, change their lives overnight, sort of thing.
That's right. I think the type of thing that could change that would, of course, be something to do with China. And China, of course, is the big, has been the big rising dragon here for the past decade and a half. And although it is not quite on the same economic tear that it has been in the past, it is still a growing behemoth, and one that's making itself felt more in the South China Sea, and more to Japan's point, in the East China Sea, where it has some disputed territories with Japan. And so the Chinese menace is not just a political boogeyman, although it certainly is that, and it serves to rouse Abe's nationalist base, but I think it also is a growing economic threat, certainly, and increasingly a military one. And the question of what will happen, for example, under a Trump administration with China could very much embroil Japan right in the heart of, at the very least, a trade war, and potentially even a war, which, of course, would change things very drastically.
So, getting back to like the preparedness reaction or preparedness theme, how do the average Japanese people really react to what's going on? Are they putting their faith in still the Japanese government, that whatever happens, if there's a Chinese invasion, or if there's just a continued de-escalation of standard of living and jobs, that the government's going to bail them out? Or are Japanese, I don't know, growing gardens or trying to take more of the initiative into their own hands and sort of prepare for themselves and not rely on the system that they've always been dependent on beforehand?
I know it sounds a bit cliche, but Japan really is a nation of startling contradictions. It is an exceptionally, profoundly conservative nation in so many ways, and yet it is one that is capable of completely upending and changing everything on a dime. For example, obviously, after the Second World War and the American administration here, Japan was completely reorganized. The people adopted a completely different mentality, going from the imperial worship of the pre-war period and and all of the war mongering that entailed, to a nation that truly thinks of itself as a peaceful nation. It is built into its constitution that it will not have a standing army to be used offensively, and all of that. So those kinds of incredible changes can occur, but then still, it is still a very conservative country, and people tend to think the same way and not to rock the boat too hard. So on that note, I think people still do tend to trust governmental institutions, even though they, I'm not even sure trust is the right word, but they go along with them, even though they know that they are failing. And one example of that is the Japanese government bonds, which has always been the form of saving for the average Japanese person. People buy Japanese government bonds and hold on to them, and then they retire and cash them in, and that's their retirement. And that's been the way that generations have acted, and still, it's still seen as a safe bet and what people will do with to act safely with their money, despite the fact that Abe and Kuroda at the Bank of Japan have been trying with all their might to get people into the stock market. So they've been pumping this kind of stock bubble at the expense of bonds, which are now going into negative territories, or at least heading that way. And people still tend to play it safe. In terms of preparedness in the food sense, there is already a profound reliance on family farms here. Every family has a rice paddy somewhere out in the countryside, where usually at this point it's grandma and grandpa, or even great-grandma and great-grandpa tend to that, and then the family comes out for the harvest and everyone gets a little bit. And so that is already kind of baked into the cake here. There is some sense of that, but it is being lost, as now the average age of the farmer here in Japan is something like 70, 73 years old or something. It is a dying generation, and the countryside is being depleted as everyone moves into the cities. So that is going to change as well in the coming years. And I don't think people have a sense of crisis about that. It's just a kind of fact of life. Oh, the jobs are in the city, so everyone's moving to the city. The countryside is falling apart, and the old farms are gradually going to be subsumed. So I see a sense of urgency in that, but I'm not sure that the average populace necessarily sees it as anything other than sort of the natural way that things are progressing.
That's very interesting. Like in America, we have already gone through that cycle, of course. We had the small traditional family farms and gardens and food plots, and then that all went away. Everybody moved to the cities, and now people have this kind of renewed sense of, you know, homesteading. And also from a health perspective, people want to eat healthy food. They want to get back to the farm. They want to have little plots of land and mini farms. And so we're kind of going full circle back around to that again. But that's interesting that the Japanese sort of, I guess, have had that through all the massive, you know, political upheaval of the past 100 years. That was still part of their tradition. And now they're kind of losing it, as you pointed out, but they're not aware maybe of the repercussions because they haven't really gone through that. That'll be really interesting to see how that plays out in the next few decades. Hopefully it plays out okay for them and they realize the importance of having their own food independence and all that sort of stuff. You know, I'm really curious too. So in the United States with this recent election, it was, I've been through several elections. This was definitely one of the most emotional ones going on. It really, it was so divisive. If you know, you look at the maps of the voters of for Trump and Hillary, and it's like it looks like, you know, two different countries, and it really felt like that here. I'm curious again, you know, looking at this sort of international you know, perspective from your eyes, what was it like in Japan or your fellow Canadians? Were people that emotional about this election? Were they that emotional after it occurred? What was their thoughts, since, you know, America, United States government, whether anybody likes it or not, and most people don't, certainly has a large, profound effect upon the rest of the world.
Well, that's certainly true. And obviously, the American elections are followed, if not closely, are at least followed everywhere in the world, Japan and Canada being no exceptions. And I'm not sure it's quite the same level of emotional involvement that obviously the Americans themselves have with that election. But there is there have been certain feelings that have been attached to this. And I think that people's emotional involvement in this corresponds to the extent to which they consume same mainstream establishment media, in which very the narrative is dumbed down to a surprising extent, and really it boils down to some very simple narratives. And I think, for example, here in Japan, people who were following the way that it was presented sort of on the nightly news, in the little sound bites and updates that they would have, I think people came away with the sense that Trump was at least a threat to the status quo and stability. And while that might seem as something to be embraced, you know, by Americans who are sick of the last however many decades of government, I think that's seen with trepidation by a lot of Japanese who, of course, like the status quo and don't like to rock the boat. So I think a lot of people bought into this line that Trump was some sort of threat. And to some extent, it's difficult to read, obviously, exactly which way the administration is going to go in the Asia Pacific. But it does look like the status quo is going to change. And one example of that, of course, was when Trump took the congratulatory phone call from the president of Taiwan. Obviously, a diplomatically sensitive issue that affects relations with China. And that's the sort of thing that Japan has to keep an eye on, because, of course, we've seen the rhetoric about, well, maybe, you know, Japan should be paying for its own military and upkeep and everything, which, again, sounds like a pretty blasé statement to most Americans. But in terms of the military relationship with Japan, I think that's a big deal. So that sort of thing, I think, upsets people. And, of course, from the Canadian perspective, Canadians are socialist by default and by birth. So I think they view Trump very much as a fascist who's coming to, you know, Hitler 2.0, and that type of narrative is probably very popular in Canada, which, of course, just recently elected Justin Trudeau as the prime minister, quite the polar political opposite. So I think, I think there's a great sense of dread in Canada about what might be coming. But those are just, again, the mainstream establishment positions and what I would assume that people who have just been fed on the milquetoast of establishment corporate media probably believe about this. But of course, there's always room for people who escape those cracks, through those cracks, and find perhaps deeper analysis elsewhere.
You know, that's interesting. You mentioned Canada. I was just there recently, and I don't really watch a lot of TV. Certainly when I do, I don't watch, you know, much of, as you just mentioned, the mainstream media. And if I do, I try to, you know, you try to cipher through it and interpret it and see the what's really going on. But it was interesting watching this Canadian TV channel, if you just landed here from Mars and didn't know what was going on the planet Earth and you're watching this, you think, oh my gosh, poor America, those poor people, they've just been taken over by this horrible, horrible Trump. And, you know, but they say it on this TV channel with, I don't know, such sincerity. I can see where the average person that doesn't understand how to find truth in the internet or how to, you know, take the mainstream media with a grain of salt and see what's going on. I could see how they would fall for it. And it was very interesting. I thought, wow, what you just said about the Canadians, it did seem like that was sort of the mainstream thought, at least from this this TV show. They were definitely speaking from a socialist perspective. And I'm curious, you know, we'll talk about Japan. Do they really investigate trying to find the truth and what's going on in political events, be it, you know, geopolitical or be it a local Japanese type event? Or do they really just sort of traditionally go along with what's said through their mainstream sources? Are they that critical at all of what they're told?
I would say that on the whole, if you're just looking at the average person on the street, I think there's a lot less of that kind of critical eye towards establishment narratives than you would see in a lot of Western countries. I think the average person is very, very uninterested in that sort of thing. And I have, before I was running the website, I was a teacher here in Japan. And so I had a chance to talk to a lot of different Japanese people from different walks of life, different ages. And I did try to test in various things, but there was just no interest. I mean, just even the JFK assassination or something, people, to the extent that they knew anything at all about it, just didn't even care. So I think that's kind of the way that people receive a lot of their information here. Now, obviously, there are, I mean, that's just kind of the average Joe on the street, and there are pockets of sort of underground and alternative media and things that happen here as well. That should not be discounted. But I think just the average sense of the average person, they tend to go along with the establishment narrative. And that's reflected in a statement from one of the Americans here that was in charge of the administration in the post-war period, who called Japan a nation of children. And to some extent, I don't think that's an unfair assessment. Especially the way you can see exceptionally basic advertising campaigns can have a profound effect on people's on the way people conduct themselves. All it takes is a cartoon character and a little, you know, a regular indoctrination on TV and billboards and that sort of thing, and people will go along with pretty much anything, which to some extent might be good, I guess. It certainly makes things a lot easier, but that, of course, is also scary when you think that people will just go along with whatever the latest fad or trend is. So I think there's a lot less in terms of criticality or thinking outside the box, as it were, in Japan.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Very interesting perspective. You know, I'm curious, too. I've seen you use this term voluntarist. I think that's how you had pronounced it. You know, speaking about concepts of freedom and different forms of anarchical government. Well, if you want to even use the term anarchical government, but just anarchy and different forms of that, and liberty and libertarianism. It's so hard to speak about what it means to be free and how people can be free without using labels that they themselves kind of complicate or subvert the meaning, because the labels themselves are tricky. So we'll try to avoid as many labels as possible. So what we've seen, you know, with this recent Trump election is, you know, whether Trump turns out to be the savior or not, the significance that I see is that so many people in America were so fed up with the status quo, so fed up with realizing the government is not existing for their benefit. All they do is just keep taking away people's freedoms, taking away their money and showering them with more regulation. So people have been reacting by, you know, for a large part of it, by preparing for whatever bad stuff is going to happen. And part of that preparation is kind of acknowledging that, okay, at the big level, the DC level, the federal level, you know, there's not a lot the average person can do to control that or to deal with that. So people have been sort of reverting into a tribalism, recognizing that, okay, local community, local friends, local tribe, that's where it's at. That's where we're going to put our focus. And in that sense, that, you know, they want to have a freedom at the same time. People want to be able to do what they want to do with their own land, their own life, their own money. And I'm kind of curious, this sense of this sort of neo-tribalism going on in America and your ideas of a free sort of society where you mention voluntarianism, how would you jibe those two, or could you, if you understand what I'm getting at?
I do understand, and it's interesting that you put it in the context of neo-tribalism, because that brings with it the sort of double edge of the sword. I think that it is important that people do foster and or rediscover a sense of community and what that means, because I think people have been so profoundly disconnected and dislocated from their communities over the past century, certainly, identifiably. Part of that is the great urbanization shift that's happened worldwide. Now, for the first time in human history, more people in the world live in cities than outside of cities. And that profound change that has occurred has meant that people have been dislocated from their neighbors. They've been put into little boxes in great giant cities where you probably don't know your neighbors and certainly don't know very many people compared to the surrounding area that you're living in. It really has changed the way that people operate, and I think generally for the worse. I think that's a detriment because, again, thinking back to something like the 1930s and the profound economic crisis of the Great Depression, at the very least, despite all of the hardships that were going on, people did have that community. They did know their neighbors. They did trust and get along with their neighbors. They traded with their neighbors. The economic pain that was felt by one person was distributed over a network, a community of people. And that was exceptionally difficult for a lot of people, but they did get each other through it. But can you imagine the kind of societal discohesion that would happen in a similar event today? It would be mayhem and chaos on a scale that we can barely imagine. I mean, you look at the Black Friday sale type of riots and things that break out.
Clawing and grabbing. Yeah.
So can you imagine how much worse it'll be if people are waiting in soup lines and that sort of thing? I mean, it's something I wouldn't even want to try to think about. So I think that has been a profoundly detrimental thing. But on the other side, when we start talking about, well, getting back down to grassroots and community, which I think is generally a good thing, but on the neo-tribal sort of, when you put it in that framework, it sounds like almost like a divide and conquer technique then, because that then all what you have is this kind of loosely connected communities that maybe together in their communityhood, but outside of that, unable to function, so that we would not be able to enjoy the standard of living that we have today. So that may or may not be something that we should strive for, but at any rate, it would be a profound change, and one that in some ways might even be easier to govern in the end, because people are more disunited, more kind of divided and easily conquered in that sense. So I think there has to be not just a localization, although I think, again, people should be thinking and looking at local sources of food and local communities and local exchanges and things of that sort. But I think we also need to create larger communities of interest. I think we're moving past the stage where we have to define ourselves by our geographical location. Certainly, we have the technology now where you can be in the United States and I can be here in Japan and we can be talking to people anywhere in the world with their iPods, you know, walking anywhere they are. It's a pretty profoundly changing environment that we find ourselves in where we can form communities of interest that may be virtual, maybe real, maybe a blend of the two. And I think we have to start looking at ways that we can start leveraging that kind of power to come together in new versions of community. And one example of that, one interesting example, I was just talking to Rick Falkvinge, who started the original Pirate Party in Sweden. And he, part of what he did there was leverage the power of what he calls the swarm, people who are interacting largely virtually, but obviously have real-world connections and real-world connected interests that are able to together accomplish things that no no individual or even a small community of individuals could possibly produce by themselves. One example of that would be in the European elections, where the Pirate Party won a substantial amount of the votes, I think 7% of the vote, off of 50,000 euros that they had to work with, as opposed to their rivals, who had a combined 6 million euros to spread their campaigns, and the Pirate Party outperformed all of them. It was pretty amazing, and I think that's an example of the type of new versions of community that can spring up, where people come around ideas and leverage their power, their online power and their virtual power, to make those ideas into real world tangible things. And I think we have to be looking at that as well, not just, although I certainly do look to community activism and community organizations as one thing that we should be fostering, but I think we should also be expanding our idea of what community means.
Yeah, that's very interesting, the ideas you're speaking about there. You know, again, like going back to that, I mentioned the demographic, the voting map. If you look at the Trump supporters versus the Hillary supporters, and it really came down to a rural versus city thing. You know, as far as landmass, there was very few or very little landmass that voted for Hillary, but it comprised half of the population of the country. And then if you look at the actual landmass that voted for Trump, it looks almost like the United States, but with a few small spots along the coasts chopped out. People have joked, you know, it'd almost be interesting if you could just sort of rearrange that that land so everybody was where they wanted to live. But, you know, obviously it's tricky. It didn't really work out super well for India when they split into Pakistan. I mean, you know, eventually they got to where they want to be, but a lot of bloodshed in the process. That's pretty interesting stuff. You know, we don't have a lot of time left here, and I wanted to ask you another interesting point. I know you're really tech savvy and have a lot of ideas on what's going on with, you know, future tech and all sorts of stuff. But one of the things I wanted to speak to you about is with the United Nations takeover of the internet, with Obama allowing them to have control of that. Now, how does that play out if we're going to have virtual communities where people are allowed to communicate freely and share ideas and share common interests, even though one person might be in Japan, another person might be on the other side of the world? If there's a group of people in the UN that don't like freedom, don't like analysis and people critical of governments and all that sort of stuff, and they're able to control the internet, how do people get around that? Or what's the end game for that? Is it going to be a game of cat and mouse, or is one side going to beat the other one?
You know, that's an excellent question. And the U.S. handover of the internet to the UN is probably a perfect example of this entire conversation and what's wrong with it and what could be right with it. I'm going to be doing some more work on this in the new year, so people can stay tuned for that. But basically, I think it's important to point out that the U.S. didn't exactly hand over the keys to the internet to the UN. Basically, ICANN is an organization, a nonprofit that's based in Los Angeles, that runs the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority Department of the Domain Name System. And that's a lot of tech gobbledygook to most people. But basically, when you type something into the browser, and I have the example here in front of me in an article I'm looking at from USA Today. So usatoday.com is what you would type in to go to USA Today's website. But what happens is the DNS is kind of an address book, and it takes that usatoday.com and looks for the server that is behind that address. And in this case, it's 66.61.174.185. So you don't have to know the actual address of the server itself, the IP address. You just need to know the easy usatoday.com. So all ICANN really does is control that system, that the address book, as it were, so that you can connect to sites easily. So really, all ICANN could even possibly do is disconnect a site from the address book. So if they don't like CorbettReport.com or any other website, then they can just take it out so that you type in CorbettReport.com and they could redirect you to a page that says, sorry, you know, we don't like this site, so you can't see it, or something like that. But if people have that direct address to the server, they could still get there just by typing the direct address in. So one way around this, I mean, one way around this would be to know the actual IP address of every single site you ever want to visit, but that might be a bit unrealistic, especially as we've all been trained to just remember these easy kind of .com domain names. One way around that is, in fact, a peer-to-peer decentralized address book. Why do we have address books that are controlled by a central authority when we're in an era in which we have decentralized ledgers? An amazing idea. And that, in fact, is already happening. There's a blockchain called Namecoin, which is being used to run an alternative address book, as you will, if you will, called .bit. And so you can register a .bit domain name, and you're not registering it with any centralized authority. You're registering it on the Namecoin blockchain, so it is decentralized by default, and no one can ever come in and censor that. And, for example, I haven't yet, but I'm going to set up CorbettReport.bit so that no authority, no ICANN, no the US or the UN or anyone else can step in and sever people from CorbettReport.bit. So that's where we're going with all of this. And it's one of those examples of the people not quite understanding what it is that ICANN actually does. So they don't understand what the problem is, and they don't understand there is already a solution. It already exists. It might take some work to get people educated about .bit and what it is and why it's important that people register with it and da-da-da. But in the end, the solution is already there. It's only people's ignorance that is preventing them from understanding that. And I think that's a manufactured ignorance. I mean, obviously, it's in the best interests of people like ICANN and others who want the control of the internet not to let people know exactly what this is all about or why it's happening or how easy it is to circumvent such a centralized authority as that. So in the end, I think that's the type of... I mean, that's a good example of the overall phenomenon that we're dealing with here, that people... have been just trained and programmed into certain very simple tasks, and this is what you do, and this is how you do it. And if you just receive that wisdom and never think about it and never question it, then you never really know how to combat that. You just go along to get along, and it gets further and further and further into this paradigm of control. But I'm telling you, there's a decentralized peer-to-peer world out there that is completely different from what we're being shown and what we're being steeped into with our walled gardens of Apple and Microsoft and all of these tech giants and Facebook and YouTube and all of these giant conglomerates that are trying to teach us that there's only one way to do everything and you have to abide by all our terms and conditions to be allowed to be on the internet.
That's really great to hear. I mean, it really illustrates that humans always find a way, right? It's like somebody builds a better radar device, and somebody then builds a better radar detector. It's always this this game of cat and mouse. So it sounds like the days of I don't want to use Google as an example of some sort of objective search engine, but it sounds like the days of Google being sort of an objective search engine are gone. But it doesn't matter, because people can communicate directly now, like you say, with just the address, right? I guess sort of like an example of, the surface web versus the dark web. Things will still work in the dark web. All that stuff's there. People will still find a way to communicate. However, the powers that be try to obscure the obvious surface of the web and try to, control people's information and communications that way.
Indeed. And again, I think you're right. It is cat and mouse, and it does require some input from people, obviously, in order to be informed and in order to understand the solutions that are available. It does require a bit of effort, and I know that's difficult. But I would rather that the default be that people understand and just look for, is there an open source solution? Is there a decentralized solution? Is there a way that we can do this without going through a tech giant? If people just get to that mindset, then the status quo itself will change. It won't be the what can I buy from Apple this week. It will be what open source platform is available for this task. And if we could just get to that sort of status quo, I think that would be a significant revolution in and of itself.
Yes, you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, basically, it's a much bigger thing than just computers or internet. I mean, we're talking about the whole big picture. Get people to think outside the box and try to shed all of the propaganda and brainwashing they've succumbed to their whole life. And there's a whole other world of opportunities out there. You know what, James, we are out of time right now. This was awesome. I really love the discussion. Lots of insightful stuff. I think our listeners are going to love it. So with that said, we are going to finish up this talk today, and hopefully we'll do another one in the future. Thanks a lot for being on Living Outside the Box. And we will talk to you soon, James.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.